In a series called Life Below the Surface, we began talking about getting a little bit deeper in our discipleship and allowing Jesus to transform some of the hidden parts of who we are. And this morning we're going to talk about what that means in terms of dealing with our past, the things that have happened in our past, the people and experiences that we have dealt with. Like any sailor needs to know what's below the surface, you and I need to know what's below the surface. This picture oversells it a little bit to show you that it's really what's below the surface that matters most. When you think about a ship coming on the ocean, it's not the iceberg above the water that they're concerned about. It's what's underneath the surface that they're going to run into first. What is below the surface of my life that if you run into is going to wreck you or is going to hurt your vessel? It's a huge question. It's a huge question because you can't see what's underneath the surface of my life. The family that I grew up in, my family of origin, is central to a lot of the stuff that's below the surface of my life and how I interact with people. And I'd say the same thing is true for you. Think about the very first family, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. What was going on below the life of Cain? And how did that manifest itself in him murdering his own brother? And the point of what we're talking about today is that you and I are part of that same family line. There's sin in our families going back 3-4 generations, all the way back to Adam and Eve. And the book of Exodus says that God allows the consequences of our sin to go 3 and 4 generations. So that means my great-grandfather, whom I never met, the things that he did, the person that he was, is influencing me today. The way that he dealt with money, for instance, greatly affected my grandfather. My grandfather grew up in the Depression. My grandfather passed on those same attitudes and values to my father. And my father, by default, passed them on to me. Sometimes I see myself grabbing onto those values, and at other times I find myself fighting against them because there's almost an overcorrection on the part of my grandfather and my father to who my great-grandfather was. And so the dysfunction just kind of flows downhill. Look at it another way. The choices that I'm making today are going to influence 3 and 4 generations to my daughters and to their children and to their children. Who said that this emotionally healthy stuff isn't important? It is very important because it's going to impact generations. And it's going to impact eternity. So what kind of sinful patterns are we talking about that we inherit from our families growing up? See if any of these you can recognize. Destructive criticisms. Abuse of authority. Lying. Secrets. Emotional withholding. Broken promises. Intimidation. Blaming. Pressure tactics, shaming, and put-downs. If we had an open mic today, almost all of us could get up and talk about one of those things or share something that's not on that list. Even in the best families, some of us come out with wounds to our self-image in who we are because of dysfunction in our families. All of our families are dysfunctional in one way or another because of sin. Some of us ignore the impact of our family of origin. Some of us underestimate the power of our family of origin. But what is for sure is that our family patterns that we learn growing up follow us to today, and they impact the relationships that we have with one another in the church, in our work environments, and in our current family structures. They can't help but follow us. They get played out in these relationships today. And I think one of the most challenging aspects of our discipleship is putting off the dysfunctional patterns of our family of origin and learning new ways, new patterns in the family of God. I'll say that again. One of the most challenging developmental tasks of discipleship is putting off the dysfunctional patterns of our old family and learning new ones in the family of God. You say, prove it. Well, I will. Matthew 12:50. Jesus is with a group of people, and his family members are outside. They can't get to him because there's a crowd of people, and they say, tell Jesus we want to see him, we want to be with him. Tell Jesus. When they tell Jesus, he has a response that's unusual. He says, Who is my mother? Who are my brothers? Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother, my sister, and my mother. He essentially says, this isn't a diss to his family, but he says, what's most important to me is my spiritual family, the family of God. Not to discount his earthly family, but he turned it on its head and said, spiritual family is more important. It's not just our families in the past, but it's also traumatic experiences from the past. I would call these earthquake events, events that shatter images that we had, that shake the ground beneath our feet. They shatter our sense of safety, and they have a long-lasting effect on us into our future. For me, it was all about divorce at a very young age. My parents divorced when I was young. Suicide in my immediate family. Murder. For some of you, it's been things like physical injuries, maybe theft or threats, abuse. Some of you have been to war. Some of you maybe have been imprisoned or had a job loss or some kind of financial loss. The list could go on and on and on about things that shook our being. Even simple things like a move from one area of the country to another, or one part of the state to another, can really shake the life of a young child because the child's world changes. Some of you have experienced things like that. Whether it's family stuff or whether it's traumatic stuff earthquake events, sometimes we really don't want to deal with those things. We don't want to do the hard work of going back in order that we can go forward. And part of what we're trying to get at today is it's important for us to go back in order for us to go forward. A couple of examples. These come from Celebrate Recovery. One of them is a rear view mirror. Okay. None of us would likely drive a car that didn't have a rear view mirror. We need that rear view mirror. It gives us perspective on what's around us. Now, we don't stare at the rear view mirror and fixate our eyes on it and drive the entire trip with our eyes in the rear view mirror, but we do occasionally look at it to get perspective. When we talk about looking at our past, it helps us get perspective. We're not going to fixate it on or obsess on it, but we are going to take a look at it. Another example is the idea of the contrast between a sofa and a springboard. If I sit on a sofa and use that imagery to talk about my past, I'm going to get comfortable there. I'm going to think about my past, and maybe I'm going to have a hard time finding anything that was difficult. For some of you, you grew up in some great families. And for others, we could sit on that couch and we could wallow in all the stuff that's happened in our lives and never move forward. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about today is more this springboard idea that we use the past and the perspective that it gives us to help spring us forward into the family of God, into new ways of dealing with things. And as we look at this from a scriptural standpoint, I think Joseph is probably one of the best places that we could go. So that's where we're going to go for today. No better example of family issues and earthquake events than the life of Joseph. So I want you to take a look at this this chart up here. This is a what was called a genogram of Joseph and his family. Okay, Joseph's right over here. Okay? Joseph is one of the youngest. He's got one younger, but he's all these are his brothers and sister, one sister and all brothers. And so there's Joseph. His father, Jacob, favors him. And we see what we see over here is a conflict between these two wives. So Jacob has four wives. And you see a split between this part of the family and this part of the family. There's conflict. Now, what we want to do is the scripture says to go back three or four generations. Let's go back three or four generations. Let's go back to Abraham, who started this whole mess. Okay, so here's Abraham and Sarah. We see lies in that family, where Abraham lies when he's with his wife. He says, no, this isn't my wife, because she was so beautiful. He didn't want the people in the land that he went to kill him and take his wife. So he lies. You see sibling rivalry between Isaac and Ishmael. You see favoritism. You see an unhealthy marriage. And you see Abraham now where he has two wives. And so you see this here is conflict. And then going down to Isaac and Rebekah, you see the same thing. Isaac does the same kind of lying that his father does. The exact same lie. Sibling rivalry between Jacob and Esau right from the womb. You see favoritism. Mom and dad favoring different children. You see an unhealthy marriage. So then when you get down to Jacob, you see it's full blown. I mean, he is the master of manipulation and the master of lies. This stuff is snowballed down to Jacob, and it's taken over his life. Sibling rivalry, favoritism. And so this is the family that Joseph is born into. And if you look at it scripturally, can you imagine this is the family that God decided to use to start the nation of Israel? It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. I don't know what God was thinking. We'll ask him when we get to heaven. But Joseph, you'll see earthquake events over here. He's betrayed by his brothers. They throw him into a pit. They want him dead. Most of them want him dead. And then they say, well, maybe we should take him out of the pit. We'll sell him as a slave to Egypt. They sold him to some people who were coming by going to Egypt. Got a good price for him. And then, so Joseph loses his country. He loses his family. He loses everything that he knows. He's about 17 years old. He becomes a slave. And as a slave, he's unjustly accused. And he's thrown in prison. He's in prison for about 10 years. In prison, he becomes known as one who interprets dreams. And one day, the Pharaoh needs a dream interpreted. So they bring Joseph in. Joseph interprets a dream. And Pharaoh says, this is right. This is right. What you're saying is right. You have interpreted a dream correctly. And part of the dream is that they need to store up food for a period of time so that they'll have food during a time of famine that's about to come. And so Joseph is made second in command of all of Egypt. He's just below the Pharaoh, kind of like the vice president. And so he starts up this food program and is able to help people during the time of famine. And what happens? His brothers, it's almost 20 years later, his brothers come. And there's Joseph. They don't know it. He looks different. It's been a long time since they last saw him. They don't realize it's him, but he knows it's them. He gives them a hard time at first, like a lot of us would do. If we met people from our past and we were in a powerful position above them, gave them a hard time. Eventually, he reveals himself to them and he hugs them and kisses them and cries with them. He has the entire family moved to Egypt. And eventually, his father dies. And you can just see his brothers melting in fear. What's Joseph going to do to us now? Our father has been holding back his wrath these years. He is going to kill us. He's going to do something to us. And I had to put myself, we did a group this Wednesday night, and we were asked to put ourselves in the place of Joseph. I put myself in the place of Joseph. And just being real here, I would want to throw these guys in a pit. I would want to sell them into Potiphar's house as slaves. I would want to put them in prison. And most of all, I'd want to say, I told you so. When I was a kid, I had this dream that I was going to rule over you. I was going to rule over my mom and dad. See? I told you so. Right? That would be my natural reaction if I'm honest. You know, I may seem like a nice guy on the surface, but you don't know what's below the surface. I'm really not that nice, but anyway. So here's what Joseph does, though. Genesis 50. In verse 15, you can see it on the screen here. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs that we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." When their message came to him, Joseph wept. I think I'm going to try that. Have someone else apologize for me, you know? That would work so much easier. Verse 18, his brothers came and threw themselves down before him. Now they're getting real here. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and he spoke kindly to them. All right, so there are three phrases in these scriptures that I want us to really focus on this morning. The first one is, don't be afraid. Joseph is a type of Christ, and we'll get to that a little bit later in the message. But as a type of Christ, when he says, don't be afraid, I want you to take that literally, and I want you to take it for yourself as you think about things that have happened in your past. Don't be afraid. 365 or more times in the scripture, it says, don't be afraid or fear not. At least one for every day of the year. If Jesus spoke the words, don't be afraid, to you about something in your past, what would it be? If Jesus was speaking those words to you today, don't be afraid, and it had to do with something in your past, what would he be saying that about? For me, my parents divorced. I was very young when this happened. And Jesus says, don't be afraid. I have a new family for you. He put me in a dynamic church when this happened. After this happened. The death of my two parents, my stepfather and my mother. Jesus said to me, don't be afraid. I can bring new life out of their deaths. You know, there have been many times in my life when my plans just didn't work out very well. And God says to me, don't be afraid, because I have plans for you, plans for a hope and plans for a future. And Jesus speaks these kinds of words to you today. Your past does not determine your future. Your future determines your present. And I say that again. Your past doesn't determine your future. Your future determines your present. Last week we talked about 1 John 3, and it says that we are called children of God. We are children of God. We're not yet what we're going to be in the future. In the future, we're going to be just like Jesus. Okay? There will be no dysfunction. There will be no patterns there. They will only be good and right and just. But for now, as we wait to become like Jesus, that future shapes who we are now. We are children of God. So Jesus speaks to you as a child of God this morning. God is bringing you into a new family, the church. And you can be a transitional figure. You look back 3 and 4 generations in your family, and you may be able to discern some unhealthy patterns, sin. I'm here to tell you this morning from the story of Joseph from the scriptures that you can be a transitional figure if you allow God to help break the chains of the past. Moving forward, things can be very different for your family. New patterns, new scripts, new life, and a new way of being. That's what God speaks into your life from the future to your present. The gospel is good news. We spoke about it last week. The gospel says about your past, you don't have to repeat the patterns of your family of origin. The gospel says that depression will not have a hold on you, will not rule you, but peace will rule in your heart. The gospel says that anger will not destroy you, but that you can use anger, and God can use anger to help motivate you to do what's right. Pain will not overwhelm you, but comfort. You are not abandoned. Loss and anxiety will not completely overtake you. And you can deal with anything in your past. Why? Because Jesus walks with you into those things as you look at them and then walks with you forward. So don't be afraid. You can come out of denial. Some of you can't even remember what your childhood was like because God allowed you to essentially forget some things that happened back there. And we can come out of denial and allow Jesus to begin to melt what's below the iceberg in our lives. For me, now I had my mother on a pedestal. She died when I was 10, so I only have so many memories of her up till 10 years old. I kind of put her on a pedestal, and I've learned some things in the last few years that have helped me understand a little bit more of the reality of the way things were and some of the decisions she's made. And I've had to deal with those now, you know, years later. I don't have to live in denial. I can know what the truth is about this because Jesus walks with me into these things that I'm being told now about the past, and he walks with me into my present, into my future. Jesus helps give us an accurate estimation of the way things are. Joseph doesn't stop with the words, "Don't be afraid." He continues and he says, "Am I in the place of God?" What an amazing rhetorical question. No, I'm not in the place of God. I couldn't control my parents' breakup, couldn't control my mother being physically abused while I was growing up. I couldn't control my mother's death. I couldn't control any of the people that have hurt me in the last 39 years. I can't go back and change any of that stuff. I'm not in the place of God. I can't punish. I can't take God's place. I can't resist God's will in any of these things. His will is for me is to forgive people who have wronged me and hurt me. Forgiveness is good for them as I forgive them, but it's also good for me. And most of all, it's for the very glory of God. That's what's at stake when we put ourselves in the place of God. His glory is diminished. Forgiving, to me, is essentially saying the matter is between you and God. I think that's what Joseph is saying here. This matter isn't between you and me, brothers. This is between you and God. I'm placing you at His mercy. I'm releasing you to God. What God decides to do with you and get the consequences that you get for what you did to me, that's with God. I'm not going to hold you accountable to that. I'm going to forgive you and release you. It's almost as if Joseph says, look, I am not in the place of God concerning you, but I'm in the place of God concerning me. In other words, I'm where I am right now, and looking back at these terrible events that you brought into my life, I've allowed God to transform me through those experiences, and I'm in the place where God wants me to be. So I'm going to stay here and leave all of that with God and you. Joseph's brothers say, look, we will be your servants. We will be your servants. And Joseph turns it on its head and says, no, you have it mixed up. You will not be my servant. I'm the servant, and I serve God. Am I not under God, is what Joseph says. Am I not under His authority? And under His authority, I have no authority over you. I'm not going to do what comes naturally. Mentioned some of those things earlier. Throw you in a pit, put you in prison, knock you down for this. I'm not going to do what comes naturally. I'm going to do what can only come supernaturally, as I am a conduit of God's love to you. Essentially, I am not going to undo anything that God is doing in your life right now. God may be working in your life. I'm not going to get in the way of that. So the big question for us today, as we look back at people in the past who have hurt us and done wrong to us, have we released them to God? Or are we in the place of God? Are we judging the situation and deciding that we get to hand down condemnation to that person? Or are we able to give that and release that to God? It's a huge question. And all the huge questions that we're asking today are on the bulletin, so you can take them home and ponder them in the coming weeks. Joseph sums up his experience with this whole thing. And he says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." Now, when I first read this, I thought it was saying that God caused Joseph to be thrown in a pit, that God caused Joseph to be enslaved, that God caused Joseph to be placed in prison. I don't believe that's true. God's plans for Joseph were plans for good, not evil. The evil that was brought into Joseph's life, I believe, was brought in by his brothers, brought in by human will. And as you and I think about the things that have happened to us in our past with various people, I want to encourage you that God didn't cause those things to happen. There's a thing called human will, free will, that we get to decide how we're going to interact with people. And often we decide to interact in ways that aren't healthy and that aren't good. Ways that God has not designed. But God is not limited by the plans, the devices, the intentions, or the meaning that someone else assigns to something that they were going to do to you. So they meant it for evil, but God made a different meaning out of it. He meant it for good. I think one of the best translations of this verse is found in the Douay Rheims Bible. It says, "You thought evil against me, but God turned it into good." God turned it into good. Romans 8:28 echoes this. In the New Living Translation, it says, "And we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to His purpose for them." If you love God today, and you're being called according to His purpose, which we're all being called according to His purpose, it says here, we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those. So catch this, because it's an important distinction. God doesn't cause all things. But once they are caused by someone, He causes them to work together for good. It's an important distinction. So the evil that fractured my original family with divorce, but God used it to give me sensitivity to what makes a lasting marriage. People have done me wrong in the area of finances, but God showed me how to depend on Him more in those circumstances than I was before. I've started some life-altering projects where I had to put my life on hold to begin a project that I felt God was leading me to do. And in several of those cases, the people that I began those projects with pretty much abandoned the project along the way. But God turned those things into good for me and for my family. He was faithful in those times. In all these things, the enemy had plans and devices for me, but God worked them together for good. What I don't want you to hear today is that Joseph is special, that Vinny is special, that God has a special plan for us, because it's not true. He has the same intentions for you. And I don't want you to take my word for it. So I asked some people this week. I said, "How has God used difficult experiences in your past and shaped them for good in your present and into your future?" Someone said, "People are more important to me now that I've been through these things. God turned it into good." Someone said, "I have a deeper dependence on God." Another person said, "I'm learning clearly the difference between an earthly father and a heavenly father." Someone said, "I'm more available to my family now. God has turned it into good. I'm keeping good relationships because God has turned it into good. I'm testifying to my family of the grace of God because God has turned it into good. It's okay for me to ask for help now. God has turned this into good. Someone said, I'm questioning everything that I do and my motives because I want to please God now. God turned that into good. Someone said, I'm loving and forgiving my family, something that Joseph did, all because God caused the difficult things to turn into good for these people. Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And when we look at their names are just full of redemption and purpose in God's good in his life. He names Manasseh. And Manasseh means making forget. Now, obviously, Joseph didn't literally forget what happened in the past. But God brought new meaning to what happened for Joseph. So that when he has this son, he says, making forget. Paul says we forget those things which are behind. Once we look at them and deal with them, and Christ melts them away, we forget those things which are behind so that we can move forward to that which is before, the prize that Jesus has for us in his calling. Ephraim, he names fruitful in the land of suffering. And so Joseph is able to say, in the land of suffering, in the land of Egypt where I came and suffered, God has made me fruitful. And the question for you and I is, has God made us fruitful in the land of our suffering? The things that we have gone through, did God waste that pain or did he use it to shape us to be more like his son, to make us fruitful for him? If you haven't allowed God to do that for you, I want to encourage you. This year, maybe you could say, God, this year, how do you want to help me see those things that have happened in my past in a different light? To remember them differently. To remember means to go back and allow Jesus to show you the meaning that he's created out of a huge mess. Thousands of years after Joseph came a man, and he too was beloved of his father. He was prophesied to become a ruler. His brothers were also jealous of him and didn't believe in him. He was falsely accused. He was condemned to die with two others, one of which ended up being pardoned and given life. He forgave those who did him wrong when he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. His name is Jesus. As we said earlier, Joseph is a type of Christ in that he points us to Christ. Without Christ, those three phrases don't mean anything. Those three phrases point us forward to Jesus. Like Joseph's brothers, you and I stood guilty. We stood condemned. And just like Joseph could have thrown the book at his brothers, Jesus could have thrown the book at us. All the laws of the Old Testament. But Jesus didn't do that. He forgave us. He knew we couldn't keep all those laws. Like the food that Joseph stored up for his nation and for the nations around him, this table stands as a symbol of God's bread to us, an endless supply of grace and mercy from our God. This table is the ultimate example of God working things together for good. You see, the devil wanted to use for evil. He moved people to crucify Jesus. But God had a different plan. He turned that into good for you and for me. God did it for you. God did it for me. Let's pray.